WRFG Atlanta, 89.3 FM, your station for progressive information. WRFG provides a voice for those who have been traditionally denied access to broadcast media through the involvement of a broad base of community elements to guarantee that access. In the utilization of the Foundation's facilities and in its programs, the following communities will receive first priority: those who continue to be denied free and open access to the broadcast media, and those who suffer oppression or exploitation based upon class, race, sex, age, creed, disability, sexual orientation, or immigrant status.
You are listening to Alternative Perspectives on WRFG-FM 89.3 on your dial. Right, and welcome to WRFG Atlanta, 89.3 FM, and you are listening to another edition of Alternative Perspectives. I am your host, Greg Bossen, and Alternative Perspectives, we like to call ourselves the only local radio hour devoted exclusively to issues affecting Atlanta's queer community. So thank you very much for joining. Before I go any further, the opinions that are expressed here are only those of myself and my guest and do not necessarily represent those of WRFG as a whole, its staff, volunteers, funders, employees, or even the listeners. Tonight's show is about sex. Well, but not the fun part, though. Tonight, we are talking about sexually transmitted infections, or STIs, which I think those of us that have been around for a while call them STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. And our guest, I would like to ask you about that when the time comes. But this is especially important these days as infection rates here in Atlanta and Georgia as a whole have been on the rise. And for some infections such as syphilis, gonorrhea, and most concerning HIV, Atlanta has some of the highest rates of infection in the nation. So we have an expert from the Centers for Disease Control or CDC here in Atlanta to guide us as we talk through these issues. But before we begin, queer news of the world. So we've been doing this for the last few weeks, and I think I like it. So we're going to start with a local story and work our way outward. So these are going to be news stories that are interesting or relevant for those of us that are in the queer community. Stacey Abrams, this is local. Stacey Abrams is heading to the Castro on Thursday for a fundraiser hosting a group of lesbian leaders in the technology, political, and nonprofit worlds. The former Democratic nominee for Georgia governor will raise money for Fair Fight, which is the voting rights group she founded after losing the election to Brian Kemp last fall. So I think that's really awesome. I like Stacey Abrams. She will be announcing which race she will be running in, so she'll be running in something. either challenging Senator David Perdue in 2020 or going for a rematch against Kemp in 2022. By the way, I am recovering from a little bit of a cold, so I'm a little bit congested. All right, so enough of that. All right, so let's see. Nationally, on Sunday night, February 24th, and you know this, Malik won. What is that? What is his full name? somebody Malik. But he won Best Actor for his role as Freddie Mercury in the Bohemian Rhapsody movie. In his speech, he addressed the audience, and he said, "We've made a film about a gay man, an immigrant who lived da-da-da." But he called the character, he called Freddie Mercury a gay man. So many people took to Twitter to express their disappointment because Freddie Mercury is actually a bisexual, not a gay man, but a bisexual. And I believe if he was alive today, he might have wanted to be known that way. So that was something that... Rami. No wonder I couldn't remember it. Never even heard of that name before. Rami. I also heard that he fell off the stage. Yeah, he did. But anyway. All right. So that was national. Another. So let me just tell you, queer is even in the air. Okay. It's even in the skies above our world. Several major airlines in the U.S. announced they are going to start offering a non-binary option on their tickets for passengers. According to the Associated Press, the gender option on airline sites will soon also list undisclosed or unspecified. There may also be the optional title MX. So far, six airlines confirmed on Friday, February 15th, that they are in the process of adding these options. And those airlines are American, United, Southwest, Alaska, JetBlue, and our good old Delta here at home. So I think that's really cool. So for those people purchasing tickets that don't consider themselves a man or a woman, they don't identify that way, we have an option for them that's coming. Couple more things. Nashville. Now, this is really surprising to me. The mayor of Nashville has signed an executive order designed to help LGBTI-owned businesses. Mayor David Briley's order will see LGBTI-run businesses as a recognized category for Metro procurement. So basically what that means, just to kind of cut to the chase here, is this will allow businesses to identify as being LGBTI owned during the procurement process and allows companies to be recognized with LGBTI business enterprise certification from the National LGBT Chamber of Commerce. So you'll go to the LGBT Chamber of Commerce, you'll be recognized, and then after that, it will allow people that are recognized as such to be considered minorities when bidding on city contracts. So I think that's really cool. I can imagine there's a lot of people that are mad about that. To those people, I say too bad. All right. And then one more thing internationally, and this is not so good. This is in Morocco. Morocco police raided a private party and arrested eight men in Marrakesh. Officers claimed to the press they were trying to stop an illegal wedding. Apparently, gay weddings are illegal in Morocco. However, according to the attendee, it was just a party and not a wedding. The officers, military police, claimed they located the supposed wedding in the town of Saada. I'm sure I said that incorrectly, about a week ago, February 16th. And it was there they found two men aged 24 and 26 wishing to celebrate their union at an event attended by, quote, high-profile Moroccan homosexuals. So, anyway, how ridiculous is that? homosexuality is illegal in Morocco, punishable by up to 3 years in prison. And the Council of Europe since 2013 has repeatedly called on Morocco to repeal the ban on homosexuality, but so far to no avail. So that is our news of the queer, or queer news of the world, and that brings us to tonight's topic. Sexually transmitted infections or sexually transmitted diseases. Now, although This is a show dedicated to issues affecting the queer community. That's the point of Alternative Perspectives. We certainly do not have the market cornered when it comes to STIs. Unfortunately, this is something that affects our straight and cisgender friends as well. So I thought I'd start with some stats and then we'll get to our guest. Sexually transmitted, this is in 2018, sexually transmitted diseases in the U.S. were at record highs, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In 2017, the CDC reported 2.29 million new cases of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis. We're going to talk a little bit about that with our guests. And this surpasses the 2016 record by more than 200,000 cases and marks the fourth consecutive year of increases. We are sliding backwards, Jonathan Merman, director of CDC's National Center for HIV/AIDS, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention. That's a long title, but Jonathan Merman said in a news release, it is evident the systems that identify, treat, and ultimately prevent STDs are strained to near breaking points. And finally, December 6th of 2018, this just happened, I guess two and a half months ago, something like that, health officials from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta said that the HIV/AIDS health crisis is still a crisis in Atlanta, and actually we rank fourth in the nation for new HIV diagnoses. So, in fact, the HIV/AIDS epidemic is so rampant that in 2016, it was likened to a third world country. Downtown Atlanta is as bad as Zimbabwe. Dr. Carlos Del Rio, the co-director of the Emory Center for AIDS Research, said this was in 2016. So this shocked me. So with us to talk about this very important issue, we have Dr. John T. Brooks. And Dr. Brooks is a senior medical advisor with the Division of HIV Prevention of the CDC, HIV/AIDS Prevention of the CDC, and has been working in this field for the last 25 years. Yeah, 25 years. So let's see if, first of all, we can hear you. So say hello.
Greg, hey, how are you?
It's and nice move in closer.
Good to hear you, Greg.
Yes, you'll
nice have to have you here.
Yeah, you can move the microphone.
Yeah, I'll just, get it real close.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Okay, that's good. We got to make sure he has a lot of important things to say, and so we want to make sure that we can hear from him. So before we get any further, I'd just like you to introduce yourself in terms of telling us what kind of work you do with the HIV, with the CDC. What specifically do you do?
Sure. So the Division of HIV AIDS Prevention at CDC is committed to preventing HIV in the United States. And a large fraction of our work is done by state health departments to help folks prevent getting HIV and for those who are living with HIV to get good care to both for their own health and to reduce the risk of transmitting to others. My job there is really to help to interpret a lot of the scientific information coming in to turn it into action for our division to make sure that we can do our best job possible maximizing the preventive effects of what we do.
Okay. All right.
I also continue to see patients, HIV-infected folks, over at the VA hospital here in Atlanta.
All right. Oh, so you're still seeing patients.
Yeah, I think it's important to see people with the condition that you're working in to really inform and understand the context of a disease that you're treating.
Definitely. Definitely. No, that makes a lot of sense. All right. Well, we are going to take a quick break, and then we'll get back. And when we get back, we will be talking about, I think we won't start with the big one. We'll start with, we'll start with the lesser worried about, sexually transmitted diseases. So we'll be right back.
Hey, this is Russ from Russ Still and the Moonshiners. We're looking forward to playing for you at WRFG's fourth annual Americana in the Park celebration. See you there.
Russ Still and the Moonshiners, just one of the great acts you'll enjoy this Sunday, March 3rd, at WRFG's fourth annual Americana in the Park celebration. This year, we're honoring our station manager, Joan Baptist, for her hard work and dedication to progressive community radio. Let's run down the artists on the bill. The Bonaventure Quartet with their thrilling mix of romantic gypsy jazz, American swing, and original tunes. The Ghost Riders Car Club playing country music that's as real as it gets. original country rock from the award-winning Russ Still and the Moonshiners. And direct from Adairsville, Georgia, 16-year-old self-taught yodeling cowgirl, Katherine Thompson. Folk legend Frank Hamilton will make a special guest appearance, and the Seed and Feed Marching Abominable will kick things off as only they can. Please join us this Sunday, March 3rd, for WRFG's 4th Annual Americana in the Park celebration. No matter the weather, we'll be nice and comfy at the Park Tavern in Piedmont Park. The doors open at noon, the music starts at 1, and we'll wrap up by 6. Americana in the Park tickets will be $20 at the door, or you can get them in advance for $15 each through WRFG.org. But please hurry, advance ticket sales end Saturday at 5 p.m. And of course, as always, kids under 12 get in free. The Park Tavern is located at the corner of 10th Street Northeast and Monroe Drive, right next to Atlanta's Piedmont Park. All proceeds benefit WRFG 89.3 FM, your independent community radio station for progressive information and hand-picked quality music.
You are listening to WRFG FM 89.3, Alternative Perspectives. And we are back. So if you are just joining us, you are listening to Alternative Perspectives, and I am your host, Greg Bossen, and we are speaking with Dr. John Brooks, who is the, senior, what is the title again?
Just say senior medical advisor.
Yeah, I think that would be easier. The senior medical advisor for the Division of HIV and AIDS Prevention at the Centers for Disease Control, and we are talking about sexually transmitted diseases. And with that, let's talk. So talk to me, and let me make sure this.
Yeah, sound. I want to make sure you can hear me, Greg.
Yeah. Okay? I think that helped definitely.
I mean, I'll get in real close to this microphone.
Yes. That's.
You don't have to put a condom on it. We're going to be okay.
Yes. And also, Dr. Brooks wanted me to say for those people that are listening, because you can stream this, that are in Nashville, that are upset that LGBT. IQ are now considered a minority and get preferential treatment on contracts. Queers are great supervisors, so don't forget that. That's very important and also very true. All right, so let's start with I think we can start with this. So before we get to the whole HIV thing, I just wanted to go over for a few minutes some of the other STIs. Syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia. I guess those are the three biggies.
Yeah, those are the three biggies. There are a few others that we worry about. Mm-hmm. Human papillomavirus, also called HPV, that can cause warts, and it can also lead to cancer of the anus, vagina, or the mouth.
Oh wow.
Hepatitis B virus and hepatitis C virus, as well as hepatitis A virus, can also be transmitted sexually, although really only hepatitis B is the one that we consider a sexually transmitted disease because it's very efficiently transmitted that way. But particularly men who have sex with men or gay men are at risk for hepatitis A, and hepatitis C can sometimes be transmitted through receptive anal sex.
Okay, so for that, now you were saying that there's for hepatitis B, that there's a vaccine for that.
Right. Something I really want folks to know is that for some of these diseases, there are vaccines that can prevent them. Many people in my age cohort, which is up there somewhere over 40, didn't have...
He's 86.
86, yeah. Yeah, just a youthful voice. But people of a certain age may not have had the benefit of getting vaccinated against hepatitis B as we now do and is now recommended for all infants. And so some people may still be at risk for acquiring hepatitis B. This is a virus that infects the liver and doesn't really cause much illness in most people at the time of infection. But if left untreated over many years, it can cause liver damage that leads to liver failure and sometimes liver cancer. So getting vaccinated for hepatitis B, if you haven't been vaccinated yet, is important. And if there's evidence that you have infection with hepatitis B, you definitely want to get treated with some effective medicines that can stop that virus from doing bad things to your liver.
So it's important, first of all, that you get tested.
That's right.
And then, because if you've already had it, then I don't know that it would make sense.
Well, you need to be tested to show that you've already got it.
Right. But if you have not gotten it, you can get vaccinated.
Absolutely.
And where can we do that? Where does somebody do that maybe, you know, doesn't have the money or a doctor to do that?
Right. So you can, federal government as well as state government here in Atlanta sponsor free clinics and community health centers for folks who may not have access to routine care in other settings. You can also go online to look on the CDC's website. And I believe there's a location that you can look up where to find a provider who might be able to provide these vaccines to you.
Okay.
But that's really something you might want to look up on the state health department or the Atlanta health department, one of your county health department lines. Many county health department centers provide this vaccine and others that you would want to take advantage of.
All right. And so just because syphilis and gonorrhea, just right. Remind our listeners, yeah. what are each one of those things,
yeah,
first of
so,
all?
Yeah, good question. So syphilis and gonorrhea, to the extent that it makes a difference, those are both caused by bacteria. Gonorrhea is a bacteria that infects our mucous membranes. So those are sort of the wet surfaces in our mouths and throat, in our anus, in our vagina. And they can cause pain. And also when it's in the urethra or the hole where urine comes out, can cause inflammation and pus to drip out of the end of the penis or out of the urethra in a woman, or cause damage inside a woman's vagina and uterus, possibly leading to infertility. And so these can be symptomatic, and it's not a disease to take lightly. You know, it can lead to problems like in women in particular of infertility and even an ectopic pregnancy. Syphilis is a different kind of infection.
Hold on, what's an atopic
pregnancy? I'm sorry, ectopic pregnancy is a pregnancy that takes place not in the uterus where it belongs, but in the tube that leads to the uterus from the ovary.
Oh, wow.
So it gets stuck. If that tube is scarred by gonorrhea or more typically by chlamydia, this other infection, which is the leading STD, I believe, right now, and actually was the most common condition reported to CDC in 2017.
Wow.
Leading infectious disease, yeah. It can damage that fallopian tube that carries the egg into the uterus, and then the egg gets stuck, and it can still be fertilized by sperm coming up through the uterus. But then the egg begins to develop into an embryo and it's stuck in that tube. And that can, in the worst case, be a life-threatening problem if it's not treated, because the fallopian tube can bust and infection can occur and it can threaten a woman's life.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. So that was, all of that was gonorrhea.
And chlamydia can do that too.
Okay. And syphilis then?
Syphilis is a little bit of a different disease. It infects our bloodstream. Mm-hmm. So it can get into the body, again, through the typical openings, the mouth and throat, anus, or vagina. And usually it causes an ulcer at the place that it enters the body. What's interesting is the ulcer is often painless, and people don't pay much attention to it because it doesn't hurt. Like, you know, if you get herpes, that's another disease. Those ulcers really burn and hurt. But interestingly, syphilis is not really often very painful. And then that goes away. And then in most people, about a month or two later, they get a rash all over their body. And it's not an uncommon story that somebody comes to their doctor complaining of a rash all over their body. And the first impression is, oh, maybe it's an allergic reaction to a new detergent or a soap. And doctors have to really ask their patients the important question about what are you doing sexually? Not something that everybody always gets asked, but I'm a true believer that you should at least ask, what are you doing in terms of sex? If you're going to ask, do you smoke and drink and do other things, to make sure that that important part of a person's life gets addressed.
So if I'm someone who is sexually active, should I be getting tested routinely for syphilis once a year, mm-hmm. even though, because there, I know in a number of cases, there's no symptoms really.
Right. Yeah. In fact, there really aren't any cardinal or typical symptoms like pain or change in your vision or something that would cause you to really seek out care. So for most people, for sexually active adults, we recommend that they all get tested for syphilis. Most people just once a year. Women who are pregnant should also be tested for syphilis, as well as other conditions, before they deliver their baby. Because these are diseases that we want to treat before baby's born. Sexually active women should also be tested for gonorrhea and chlamydia each year. So that's generally women who are younger than 25. People are obviously sexually active sometimes up until the day they die, but the young age group
with any luck,
that's right, yeah. Come and go at the same time, yeah. But the
that's nice,
yeah. But the it's really the young people that we care a lot about. Now, if you're a man who's having sex with men, that's gay men, but also any other man who has sex with men, you need to be tested not only for gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis each year, but you might want to be tested more often depending on your sexual behavior. You also need to be tested for HIV every
year. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
And what's interesting is you want to make sure that if you're getting tested for gonorrhea or chlamydia, that your doctor tests not just your urine, but also your anus and your mouth, if that's a place that you might have been exposed through oral sex or through anal sex. In fact, what's interesting but a little disturbing is that most of the gonorrhea and chlamydia infections occur not in the urethra of gay men, but in what we call extra genital sites, or sites outside of the genitals. That's the anus and the oropharynx, or the mouth and the throat.
And these are so apparently there's a number of doctors that aren't aware that this is the case, that you need to be educating your doctors, maybe in some rural areas, I guess. I don't know.
Yes or no. I mean, I hope that every person's taking care of patients who administers STD testing is aware of what they need to do. I think the most important message I'd have for listeners is tell your doctor what you're doing. And listen, I know that can be hard. A lot of people have internalized stigma around their sexual behavior and maybe a little bit embarrassed about it. But the doctor that you see needs to know what's going on to do the right thing to find out if you have these infections. And if you don't like the treatment that you're getting, if someone is shaming you or making you feel bad, find somebody else.
Right.
And if you need to, tell them what test you want to get checked for. And if they think that's a bad idea, they're going to tell you.
Right, right. So I want to just touch on the rise of syphilis in particular, mm-hmm. I believe. What are the statistics telling us about this?
It's really, at least looking now specifically at men who have sex with men, and I would put in that category trans women as well. Although our statistics are pretty much limited right now to MSM because the number...
MSM means men who have sex with men. So whenever we say MSM, it means men that have sex. I'm a big freak about acronyms.
I'm the same way. And the MSM also means marginal structural modeling, and that's not what we're talking about. Yeah. No, but MSM is the term we use because we pay attention to the behavior and not the person. I want to talk about a penis in the anus of a man, or the penis in the mouth of a man, or that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
So anybody who's in that circumstance, a man who's having sex with other men, whether they're also having sex with women or not, we look at the statistic, it's pretty alarming. Men who have sex with men comprise maybe 5 to 10% of the population. Estimates vary. But if you look in 2017, of all of the syphilis infections that were diagnosed, 68% of those infections were in men who have sex with men. So there's a very disproportionate representation of among those getting syphilis. And the same patterns seen with gonorrhea. You know, 1989, of all the gonorrhea infections that were occurring, less than 5% of them were in men who have sex with men. And that has risen to around 35% in 2017.
Why do you suppose that is?
It's probably a combination of two things. It may be better testing of men who have sex with women and women. But we also think it's due to a variety of other factors that can increase a person's risk for these infections. Those include being more sexually active. The number of sexual partners is a big risk factor for getting an STD. You know, each time you have sex, you have the opportunity to encounter one of those bacteria or viruses that would like to use you to reproduce itself. It's not your fault, but they just came along and there they are. Also, we think that decreased access to healthcare may lead people to, one, not be diagnosed, and so then have the infection spread from them to others before it can be treated. So, you know, treatment for these infections stops them and can be curative. Also, decreased access to healthcare means you may not have access to the knowledge about how to prevent getting these infections, which I hope we'll talk about in just a moment.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, the things you can do to prevent getting them. And then internalized stigma is a real problem for some populations. You know, stigma can be expressed as either verbal harassment or outright discrimination or even physical assault against you based on who you are and what you're doing. And that can not just be an external force, but that can develop to an internal force, and it can lead to shame and other emotions that may make you not only hesitant to seek care or late to seek care, but then not fully disclose what's going on when you're in the presence of a provider, healthcare provider.
Yes. Yeah, and I mean, this is true for these diseases as well as HIV.
That's absolutely right. They all have this, they're all transmitted, they all can be transmitted the same way. Mm-hmm. So the forces that are leading to these increases, that's one thing they share in common.
All right. All right. Well, and if you are just listening, just tuning in, you are listening to Alternative Perspectives on WRFG FM 89.3 on your dial. And we are speaking with Dr. John Brooks of the CDC regarding sexually transmitted diseases. We'll be right back after this break.
Song. Wow.
Yeah. Did you like
that? I've never heard a song where they got the word shanker in there.
Yeah.
That was good.
There's not very many of them.
Shanker is another word for an ulcer, basically.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always called it, is it different from a canker?
No.
Or am I just pronouncing it right?
People, it depends on what part of the country you're from. Some say canker sore. Some call them cankers or shankers.
And so if you're just joining us, you're listening to that is Dr. John T. Brooks. Who is the senior medical supervisor for the...
I basically help our division of HIV and AIDS prevention fulfill their mission.
Ah, thank you so much. I seem to have lost my note on that, but...
Well, and talking about STDs can fluster some
people. It does. It does make me...
And I'm sorry, I keep using STD and STI interchangeably.
Can you mention that? Because, I mean, is that... I thought STDs were a thing of the past. I thought everybody used it.
We want to focus people's attention not on having a disease, but having an infection. Because an infection is something that doesn't care who you are. It just... You're the unhappy person who gets a hitchhike from that disease. And so we want to focus on that because also the infection is what we can treat.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So I knew that there was some reason why that changed. So we've been talking about the syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, HPV a little bit. And syphilis in particular has been on the rise, but talk a little bit just for a second about where you're seeing that rise in terms of populations.
Yeah, I want to make another point here that, you know, the same way that men who have sex with men are one of our populations that it's at special risk for getting these STIs, that is increased risk, basically. Also, these diseases are not equal opportunists when it comes to your race and ethnicity. You know, if you look at our 2007, our sister division at CDC, the division of STDs, if you look at the data they produced in 2017, MSM accounted for about 70% of all syphilis cases. And so early we'd said about 68, I'm going to round up to 70%. But if you break it down by race, 28% of those infections were among Black men, who represent only about 13% of the population. So they were twice as likely to get this compared to white men, who represented 36% of infections, but probably are around 60% of the population. So if you're a Black or African-American man who's having sex with men, your risk of getting these diseases is greater than a white man. Likewise, we see a similar but smaller disparity between Hispanic-Latino men, where about, where, you know, a larger fraction were getting syphilis compared to the fraction they represent in the population. Now, these are just data for syphilis, but I think similar patterns have evolved for other STIs, and also in particular for HIV infection.
All right. And so let's move to the biggie, as it were, which is HIV. And so just for our listeners that I guess for whatever reason, maybe they're young and they don't know the specifics, just a little minute-long lesson about what exactly HIV is.
Sure, and they may also be older and have been misinformed. So just to get a clean slate here, HIV is a virus that infects your body. It can be, it's most commonly acquired through sexual contact, although it can be transmitted through injection drug use. It used to be transmitted through exposure to blood products like a blood transfusion, although now those kinds of transmissions have not been seen for many, many years because we do a really good job at protecting the American blood supply. But the virus enters the body and then it infects these white blood cells that are critical cells for the immune system. They're called T cells. And the way that this disease causes illness in humans is it kills these T cells. The virus uses the T cell to make copies of itself, and it's using the machinery of that cell to replicate. And in the process of doing it, it destroys the T cell. So every time it destroys a T cell, thousands, if not millions, of other virus particles are produced, and they each infect individual T cells. In your body every day when you're living with HIV infection, there's a constant battle against the number of white cells, these T cells that can be produced, and the number of virus particles that are being produced. And slowly over time, the virus wins out. And it can decrease the number of these critical immune cells to a point that your immune system doesn't function properly any longer. And you can become at risk for infections and cancers that don't affect people with a healthy immune system. And these are the old diseases they used to be called, and they still are called, opportunistic infections or illnesses that can kill people.
Yes.
Thankfully, today, we have remarkable new effective therapy that is simple to take. For a person newly diagnosed with HIV today, they could take one pill once a day and expect to relatively rapidly cut off that virus replication in the T cell so your immune system is not damaged. And a person who's diagnosed and treated early and stays engaged in effective care can expect to live an average lifespan.
And we've come a long, long way.
Very long way.
In a lot of areas. One of those areas is how the virus gets transmitted. And I'll just relay this story. When I came out of the closet and finally kissed my first boy, it was 1988, and I had never done anything sexually with anybody, man or a woman, never. So my very first experience, I already had HIV as a thing that I was worried about. So anyway, I went to the bar, it was the Armory, and I kissed this one boy, just a quick kiss. The next morning, I was on the phone with the Centers for Disease Control, and they told me that, yes, indeed, I could have gotten HIV from that kiss.
That's 1988, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you know, look,
it's for people that are, and I'm 53 now, so it really, there's a portion of the population that's like, I've never known sex without the risk of death. You know,
right.
It's
and
sad.
It is, but I just want to tell people that this is something that we think a lot about. You know, I'll just say with regard to what happened in 1988, you know, we're very cautious. We're the protection people.
Of course.
And so, you know, we're always going to err on the side of saying, well, it's not 100% zero risk, but really the risk of getting HIV through a kiss is very low. If this were public enemy number one, the way that it was transmitted, you know, we'd be seeing a heck of a lot more people with HIV today. Really, the way that most people get HIV is through intimate sex, and that means anal or vaginal sex. And I just want to remind the audience that that includes anal sex for women as well, not just men. Receptive anal sex, so having a penis in your anus or your bottom, is the most risky thing for transmitting HIV. Receptive and insertive vaginal sex are lower, but there's still a risk there because we certainly know plenty of people who've been infected that way. And although there are case reports of people having been infected through oral sex, it's such a low risk that it's hard for us to really quantify. We know that it probably isn't zero, but it's not something that's easy for us to quantify.
Yeah, so that's a thing that I struggled with myself because unfortunately, you know, I'm a bit of a hypochondriac, and there's just a couple of things in this life that freak me out, and one of them is medical issues. It's not pretty. He's laughing because I think he knows.
You need to get out of your full body condom one day.
Oh, well, let me tell you, my doctor, she's an incredible doctor. I love her. But she told me when it comes to oral sex, she said, do not go anywhere near a penis with your mouth. And I mean, you know, I'm like, it's easy for her to say. She was a lesbian.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, all right. But you know, look, I mean, again, this is like kissing. If this were the way that HIV were being efficiently transmitted, we would have probably seen a lot more infections that we could attribute to oral sex. And the studies that have looked at it haven't really been able to document that as anywhere near as risky as vaginal or anal sex. I mean, that's really where we want people to pay attention. Also, you know, our mouth and also vagina in women over time have evolved defenses to try and prevent infections from getting into our body. Yeah, I mean, in general, foodborne illness and other infections, our bodies are built to try and prevent that. It's not 100%. Certainly, somebody could be infected through their mouth, but that would not be the number one thing I would worry about.
Well, I guess I just, and we'll leave this. I know I'm sticking to it a little bit, but it's because it's been such an issue for me because I like oral sex.
A lot of people like oral sex, yeah. And they should know that.
And so the idea of having oral sex with a condom is certainly, I guess it's safer. Mm-hmm. But what do you say to somebody who is trying to decide whether or not?
That I think the risk is very low. Mm-hmm. And if you're really concerned, if you're not using a condom, then you might want to consider not having the ejaculation in your mouth. Mm-hmm. Even then, you know, we think the risk is very low. It's up to you to try and make a decision that is a tolerance that you can learn to live with.
Well, and is there, and I've always heard this, but there's HIV in the pre-cum as well. Mm-hmm. And so if you decide to give oral sex, but you're not going to have the ejaculate in your mouth, I've heard some people say, well, the pre-cum even has a higher rate of infection than the actual ejaculate. Yeah, I don't know if that's true or not.
Pre-cum or pre-ejaculate, whatever you want to call it, can contain HIV that can be infectious.
But is it higher than
ejaculate? I don't know off the top of my head to tell you the honest truth. But the point I guess I'd make here is that the amount of pre-cum, unless you have somebody who's producing a lot, compared to the volume of semen in an ejaculation, is much smaller.
Okay.
And the cases where there have been a few well-documented cases of transmission from exposure in the mouth or the throat. The person's mouth or throat was exposed to HIV either through blood in their mouth or throat or through semen. But those have been in cases where their mucosa were not intact. They had a broken tooth and were bleeding, or there was some other sore or a cut or an opening. So if you have intact oral mucosa by brushing regularly and flossing, you know, the risk is very low.
Right. I still wouldn't floss right beforehand,
no,
though.
No, I mean, yeah.
But
you might rinse with, you know, if it's smelly in your mouth, you're worried about your breath, you could maybe use some Listerine or something.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. All right. Well, this is awesome. We've got more time, so we're good. We're going to take a quick break again, and then when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. John Brooks of the CDC, and we are talking specifically about HIV. We will be back shortly.
found a perfect apartment to rent.
My school is right down the block.
Can we go to the park anytime we want?
Yes, sweetie.
Then, after we were turned down, how was I going to explain? The landlord doesn't want families with kids in his building?
So we made a call and found out that's illegal.
If you think you've been discriminated against, Metro Fair Housing may be able to help. For more information, the number is 404-524-0000. This is another public service announcement brought to you by your listener-sponsored and supported community radio, 89.3 FM, WRFG.org, your station for progressive information and handpicked quality music.
And we are back. For those of you that are just tuning in, you're listening to Alternative Perspectives on WRFG FM 89.3 in Atlanta, FM 89.3 on your dial, and we are talking STD, specifically HIV, with Dr. John Brooks, with the Center for Disease Control.
You can say CDC.
The CDC, yeah. Yes. And specifically, this is perfect for you because he is a senior official.
The senior medical advisor.
Yes, senior medical advisor for the HIV AIDS Prevention Division. So, all right. So we were talking a little bit about how to get it. Obviously the main way of getting HIV is through anal sex, basically being the recipient of anal sex.
Although vaginal sex is also a common way of getting HIV, mm-hmm. and is one of the predominant ways we think is transmitted outside of Africa and in this country too.
So if you are interested in finding out what your level of risk is, I think you were telling me there's a CDC site that will help you with that, a risk website. Talk about that for a second.
There's something called the risk reduction tool that you can find on our website. If you type in HIV or CDC HIV risk reduction tool, you can find a website that you can enter information about yourself and what you're doing and see how changing your behavior from receptive anal intercourse to insertive anal course or having an STD versus not having an STD or using condoms versus not using condoms changes your risk for either acquiring HIV if you have the infection, and for people with HIV, it helps them understand their risk of potentially transmitting to their sexual partners.
And where do we go? Because this, first of all, it's like I took a look at it earlier. So it's a series basically of questions. And then they kind of show you what your risk level is as compared to what it would be if you had other behaviors.
Basically, since the highest risk behavior is receptive anal sex, everything else is shown in scale to what the risk would be compared to that. Yeah. And we hope that it's helpful for consumers to understand, sort of put into context the risk, how risky things are for what they're doing. It also includes what is the effect of treatment for HIV, if the treatment's effective and it suppressed my viral load.
And that's something to, it's called the risk calculator, HIV risk calculator.
I'm going to find it right now.
Okay. And what's neat about it is it's not just for people that are HIV negative. It's for people that are HIV positive to assess their risk of transmission. And I think that... Are you looking for the site now? Mm-hmm. But I think that is a good segue.
Yeah, you know, I can get. Oh, there it is. Let me give people the website.
Sure.
It's https://www.nancycdc.gov/ HIV risk, one word. And there's a lot of information there about HIV and what increases and decreases risks, but there's also this tool that can help you look at how different behaviors and different interventions to reduce your risk or increase the risk change.
So let's talk a little bit about, first of all, the obvious answer is using condoms, for one, in terms of prevention. But then over the last few years, we've had, I don't know what came first, PrEP or PEP?
Yeah,
I think PEP did.
Yeah, it sure did.
So what does PEP stand for?
Yeah, let me talk about this just a minute. So just so folks know, I just want to remind people that you know, the best way to not get any STD, including HIV, is to not have sex. But none of us would be on this planet if somebody didn't have sex. And so for those people who can't abstain, that's a reasonable thing to do. But many people still choose to have sex. Thankfully, we have children. And ways that you can reduce your risk then is just limiting partners or being monogamous with the same partner, getting vaccinated for the disease I mentioned before, hepatitis B, and this other virus, human papillomavirus, and using condoms. And also getting tested, because at least for the treatable STDs, you want to get tested for them. So for like gonorrhea and syphilis, knowing people who have gonorrhea and syphilis, if they're HIV negative, they have a greater risk of acquiring HIV if exposed. And if they have, if they're living...
Why is that?
Because these infections alter the mucous membranes in a way. They get inflamed from the infection, or these infections do other things, so that if you're exposed to HIV, it makes it a little easier for it to get into your
virus body,
to get across these barriers.
Gotcha.
And the other way around, if you have HIV and have an STD, your risk of transmitting it to others is increased, because these infections cause inflammation that can increase the amount of HIV that's drawn into those body compartments. So getting tested for these STDs is a way of protecting yourself against either getting or transmitting HIV.
And why don't we talk real quick, since we're there, where would somebody go if they wanted to get tested?
Yeah.
And they, you know, they don't have a doctor and they don't know what to do.
So we have a website at CDC, and you can go there and look for information about where to get tested for STDs, as well as information for some of these other interventions that we're mentioning. And that is www.gettested. That's one word, gettested.cdc.gov. And you put in your zip code, and it will show you where facilities are close to you to get HIV tested for STDs, and also some of these interventions we're going to talk about, like post-exposure prophylaxis, but more likely pre-exposure prophylaxis.
So let's go there, because we only have a few minutes left, and this is important. We'll talk about PEP, which stands for post-exposure prophylaxis.
That's right. So exposure means you think you've been exposed to HIV. Post-exposure means, what can I do after an exposure to reduce my chance of actually becoming infected if I've been exposed? Let's say I had sex last night and the condom broke, or I wasn't using a condom at all, and I'm really worried that I might have gotten exposed to HIV because, you know, I don't know who it was.
It's always the next morning.
It's always yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You can take 30 days worth of HIV medicine. It's the same medicine we use for treating HIV. And if you take that for 30 days, within 72 hours of the time that you were exposed, that will substantially reduce your risk of acquiring HIV infection. So we push the envelope here. We want people to seek this out as soon as possible. After 72 hours, the evidence is not very clear that it's effective.
So so it gets a little scary for, I mean, I remember.
It's a scary thing.
Yeah, because here I am, it's the next morning, and all I would do is oral, and then the next day I was freaking out. So I would call, and it would be a Sunday, and I'd call my doctor, to try and get a prescription. I'm glad to hear we have at least 3 days, but I assume the sooner the better. So how easy is it to get a hold of these pills if you don't even have a doctor or?
Yeah, so one strategy is to visit an emergency room and see if you can be prescribed the medication there. Many emergency rooms stock these same medicines for post-exposure prophylaxis for employees in the hospital who may get a needle stick with blood that could have HIV infection. You just need to tell them that you've had a sexual exposure, that you think you might need this medicine, PEP, P-E-P, or post-exposure prophylaxis, to prevent it. They'll assess you. They may do some they'll do some HIV testing just to see if you may already have it, and if you don't, this treatment's merited or it's worth doing. And then they'll want you to follow up with your doctor when you complete the treatment, monitor maybe some lab tests, and get you started right then.
Okay. All right. So now the other option that that people are doing, is people that are sexually active, is they're going on PrEP.
That's
so
right.
What
so,
is PrEP stand
so
for?
PrEP is pre-exposure prophylaxis. So taking medicine before you might be exposed to prevent you from getting HIV infection. The medicine that's currently approved in this country for that use is a combination of two drugs that comes in one pill. Their drugs are called tenofovir and emtricitabine. It can be prescribed by any physician. It's not quite the same as PEP, where you give the person the same dose of medicine you would give for treating HIV. PEP is you don't need as much medicine to prevent getting it. And for this, you take the pill once a day right now, our recommendation is to take it once a day, every day, although there may be some other options that are available to folks.
Does it matter when you take it?
You want to take it at the same time every day, but it doesn't matter what time of day you take it.
Okay.
And then that can, over time, within 7 days, usually for anal sex, and we think it may be as high as up to 21 days for vaginal sex, can protect you against getting HIV if exposed. Now, this is not, you know, if you're not sexually active or you only have one partner, this may not be the best option for you. But for persons who are sexually active with more than one person or have had an STD recently, or an STI, rather, excuse me, I just did it right then, yeah. Have an STI, which shows that you've been engaging in behavior that might transmit HIV, it's something to consider with your doctor.
And we're going to finish here, but there's two things I want to cover real quick. One is unrelated to this. It has to do with the testing that I've been meaning to ask. You know, they say you need to wait a month before you get a test to see whether or not. How long will a test show?
There's testing. If you go to get a test that's done in a laboratory today, that test if they do the right test, which is something called an antibody antigen test, but the most advanced form of HIV testing we have, on average, it will detect an infection around 10 days after it's occurred.
Okay. And then the last thing that I wanted to cover, which of course now I've forgotten about, is
you're only 53. How did you forget?
If you had your druthers.
Yes.
If that's a Southern thing, which we should mention, we were talking before, we think that's why the infections are so high here, because we don't, in Atlanta.
That's a complex story.
Yeah.
You want to ask a question.
But if you had your druthers, what would the gay community be doing? What is it that you want for people? Do you want anybody who, first of all, is HIV positive to get tested early, immediately go on PrEP, assume? Go on medication.
Anybody who knows they have HIV, please find a way to get medicine. You know, there are people out there who want to help you. Mm-hmm. And there are ways, some people don't realize that there are ways for them to access medication. Our government has a system to provide medication at no cost to people living with HIV. Taking that medicine as prescribed and staying engaged with your doctor is the best thing you can do for your health. It also will reduce your risk of transmitting the virus to others, which hopefully will take a burden off your shoulders. This is something that really, really is heavy for people living with HIV. And this movement called U equals U, folks may want to look it up, is trying to remind everybody that if you get effective treatment, your risk of transmitting to others is effectively none.
So it seems like it's important, not just for you, but for the world.
Yeah. The other thing I want to remind people is if you don't have HIV, get tested regularly. And if you're having multiple sex partners or you had an STD, talk to your doctor about whether you might be a good candidate for pre-exposure prophylaxis.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you very, very much, John. This was Dr. John Brooks from the CDC. I've learned a lot. Thank you very much, John. I appreciate you coming.
My pleasure. I hope the folks got something as well.
Oh, yeah. I hope so, too. So thank you very much for listening to Alternative Perspectives, 89.3 FM on your dial. And up next is What the Folk. What the Folk. All right. And next week, it's pledge drive time. So get out those wallets.